Well, good afternoon again, my friends. Friends, you know, this is an interesting term because DK has told us that hierarchy is friendship in its truest sense. Now, we're dealing with the six stages of discipleship, and it's the last section in Dyna 1, Discipleship in the New Age, Dyna 1. And I always, well, usually anyway, like to make a little segue between the programs just to keep the continuity. And what is going to be said here for a segue is of the utmost importance in how we treat others and avoid the pitfalls of glamour. Disciples need to learn the distinction between true analytical insight and so-called criticism. We remember that suspicion, Ray 1, self-pity, Ray 2, and criticism, Ray 3, are foundational causes of glamour. But analytical insight is not criticism, and so often DK is suggesting or implying, let me help you analyze this situation. So going on, a master does not criticize the members of his ashram. Well, and let's think of that with respect to our groups as well. Groups of which we may be members, and groups that we may have founded, or of which we are the director, in a sense. A master does not criticize the members of his ashram. He seeks to analyze for them the points wherein they may hinder the usefulness of the service of the ashram. Always those points exist, and probably we would be shocked if it were pointed out to us in a lovingly analytical way, wherein we may be the cause of some of the hindrance due to the fact that we have not overcome illusion, glamour, and Maya. There is a basic distinction between this constructive aid and the criticism. I wonder if I can pronounce that word. The criticism, which is based, look at this, on a sense of personal superiority and a love of fault finding. You know, some people think that the further you tear down another individual, the higher you rise. Of course, the exact opposite is the truth of the matter. In fact, it's only when we really find the goodness, the beauty, the potential of others, and advance that according to our best abilities, that we rise too. It's a bit like trying to get through the door of initiation all by yourself, without grasping the hand of brothers on either side. The door is wide enough for many approaching it with in an attitude of love and spiritual comradeship. It's far too narrow if the person is egotistical and self-centered and tries to go through that door on the basis of really a kind of self-love, a sense of personal superiority. So these are foibles which must be assiduously detected, and we must not give in to them. So many are the demands of the path. So many details. And when we overlook the little ones, the big process will stop. What does Master Moria say? That even the smallest grain of sand can stop the largest wheel. So let's not, when we think of improvements that might be called for from us, let's not say, oh, that's too small, it's negligible, it's not really meaningful in this process, because that may be the very thing, that little thing, hard to recognize in ourselves, but that little thing may be what is holding us back from initiation and holding the group back from the type of service it might offer. You just have to be grateful for this outpouring from hierarchy, which without glamour and delusion, and in an organized manner, has laid out the way we are to tread the path. The path always beginning, we know, now, at the first initiation, when the true aspirant appears, even though in terms of discipleship, it's still a probationary stage. So we're on program 15. That was the little segue. And today is June 12th, 2021. I don't want to lose a century there. And we're on page 730. Each master has reached the point where the vision is clear to him. This is part of the reward accorded to the initiate, clarity of vision. He identifies himself with it, coloring it necessarily, richly and helpfully, with his ray apprehension, that which he has grasped and utilized as the rays which express his nature, to apprehend, to take to oneself and grasp, and interpreting it in terms of his contribution to the whole. That's the question. Do we have this growing clarity of vision, really? That's the key. And if we do, we'll be in a position to be ever so much more useful, and we will not be the blind leading the blind. I think in the beginning, you just can't help it. You're both going to fall into the ditch, you know. Clarity of vision, real clarity of vision and projected understanding into the future, not easily developed. And we lead and guide and assist the best we can. And after a number of errors and unfortunate circumstances that befall us, we finally begin to understand how best to lead and to guide. We are sadder but wiser. Clarity of vision. Pause for a moment. Think of the degree to which you see the vision clear. Because to be a true server, an effective server, someone who's really helpful in bringing the divine plan forward, increasing clarity of vision is required. So here is the idea. Clarity of vision, developing towards mastership. You know, I personally think Master DK's vision is so clear, and he sees so many things with respect to the people he counsels, to the group he counsels, that he has to be most most selective in deciding exactly what he can say. There's so many things he could say, but he has to choose according to the foreseen reaction of those to whom he imparts what he says. And he has to choose the most important, the most essential. If we could only gather in our own lives the sense of what is most essential, and bring those things forward, the entire elevation of our groups and our nations and humanity as a whole would increase in rapidity. So he interprets it in terms of his contribution to the whole. So many of us may think, what is my effect upon the ashram? What is the ashram's effect upon me? These are still individual considerations. And we're not thinking in terms of our contribution to the whole as we can conceive it. And for us, the whole pretty much is the planetary progress. We can think in terms of the solar system speculatively and beyond, but it's our planet that we are responsible for. And even more specifically, our particular chain of globes, the Earth chain, and our little globe, the fourth globe in the Earth chain. Our responsibility lies here. That for us, in a way, is the whole. But we do have to get beyond the tendency to keep our eyes upon the personal self. It's an instrument. It has to be rendered into good condition, but we cannot confuse the instrument with our real identity. Okay, going on. Therein lies the secret of the inevitable and the unhinderable. Maybe there's not such a word. DK asks, is there such a word, brother of mine? The inevitable and unhinderable, unobstructible, we might say. And there is such a word as that. Success of the vision, as it is materialized through the combined efforts of the hierarchy, conditioned in time and space by some master or group of masters working on some one ray or rays. Think in terms of the whole. This is what Master DK is encouraging us to do. Think in terms of the whole. For many of us, the next whole is the group to which we belong. And when we think of our identity in group terms and of the welfare of the group, it's quite a step beyond thinking of our own individuality and its success or apparent failure. In the early days of the present cycle of hierarchical effort between 1925 and 1936, now remember the let's see here. the new group of world servers was introduced. To disciples and aspirants, and even to the general public during these years, important years, because of the movement of the ashrams and the great centennial conclave in 1925, and some height of goodwill work reached in the year 1936. I'm trying to think of from where I can begin to reckon. But I am recalling that 36, the first great invocation, I think, was introduced in 35 and spread in 36. And it had been the hope of hierarchy to induce such a movement of goodwill that the great danger of the to hierarchical eyes, imminent onset of the second phase of the Great War could be avoided on the physical plane. But it was not successful. And I suppose we have to look at the priorities of disciples at the time to judge why it was not successful. But anyway, in the early days of the present cycle of hierarchical effort, and some of this is being written, I think, during this 11-year period, the ray at work upon humanity was the first ray. The activity of this ray culminated in the declaration of war by Great Britain in 1939, when the destructive force of that ray, misapplied and misdirected, led Germany to invade Poland. I know it seems like we may be talking about ancient history here, you know, going back so far, but it was such a pivotal point, this Second World War, this, in the view of some, this Armageddon period. I remember a number of knowledgeable people speaking of the Second World War as, sorry, as the Armageddon. Well, the Allied forces of the United Nations, not the Axis powers, could only take so much. And so in 39, there was the declaration of war against the abuses of the first ray by Germany and other Axis powers. And this declaration meant that the United Nations would fight back. If we had not, when I say we, I mean the forces of the United Nations, if we had not succeeded in the latter part of the Great War, i.e., the Second World War, things would be very different now. Even if, well, the question would arise, would any democracies remain on the planet? Because an all triumphant Germany, Japan, Italy to a lesser extent, would have been a great corrupting of the intentions of the hierarchy. So it was a pivotal period, even though we have to look back 80 or 90 years to participate thoughtfully in what was happening. Now, every century, the first ray is released, and there is at the great conclaves a release of first ray power. This we can expect in the years immediately before us, the year 2025. Specifically, now more about cycles. In 1932, the influence of the second ray began to assert itself. Notice how you add 7 years to 25 to get 1932. We have to see how these ray cycles are derived, and will continue to do so, this tells us when this is written, until 1945. And so the great year 43, when Gemini was so powerful and the Christ was making his great decision and reaching a high point in the lengthy process of the seventh initiation, that year was included in the years leading to 45, when the great invocation was released. See, D.K. is hinting at cycles here, about which he does not elaborate. So, you know, if we're intelligent enough to put this all together, we may learn something about these cycles. So the second ray influence came in, and it seemed to reach a kind of crescendo in 1936, and it was to continue being strong toward 1945, before which great second ray deliberations occurred. And then in 45, when the seventh ray will swing slowly into activity. You will have, therefore, or you will then have three rays producing simultaneous effects upon mankind. And these three rays are often emphasized by various spiritual groups as indicating the way of the future. The first ray of will or power, expending its force, now The war ended in 45. And so did this particular first ray cycle. The second ray of love wisdom reaching its meridian and holding the center of the stage until 1957. We don't hear very much about 1957 in other descriptions, but that is kind of a 15-year cycle. 15, of course, correlates more with the sixth ray. And DK elaborates on 150-year segments that are ruled by different aspects of the sixth ray. But the sixth and the second ray are close. And then the seventh ray of ceremonial order coming into activity in combination with the other two, as the seventh ray is wont to do. The seventh ray seems to combine influences of even all the first three rays. The will to love, the will to order, producing beauty out of the present chaos. Well, when you look at the will to love, it seems a combination of the first and second ray, and it is grasped by the seventh ray. To produce, and in producing the will to order of the seventh ray, produces beauty out of the present chaos. So let's do a little bit to outline all this in the appropriate colors. Sorry, my voice here is a little raspy at the moment, but one persists. Very interesting year, and not too readily expected. But as I say, apparently a kind of a 15-year cycle. That first ray cycle was 11 years until 45. And I'm not sure we really know how long this seventh ray cycle lasts. We have a lot of pieces to put together. And although we may know a few things about general ray cycles, there are many little intricacies woven within the larger cycles. 1945, well, let's see, from the time we're doing this, it was 76 years ago, about. And the question is, to what extent is this particular cycle of the seventh ray coming in? Somewhere we're told that the seventh ray cycle is quite rapid in its appearance and its disappearance. And I think we can look at it as being a 70-year cycle in this context. Of course, it could be 7, 70, 700, 7,000, and so forth. But rays 1 and ray 7 have the distinction of having cycles in which the ray number is important in producing the number of years when the ray is in power. For ray 1, 1, 10, 100, 1,000, 10,000, 100,000, 1 million, and so forth. And something similar for the seventh ray. So the category we seem to be looking at here might be the 70-year category, in which case the year 2015, I think, would be really important. We have passed that now. But the seventh ray is becoming stronger and stronger as the age of Aquarius approaches, because in its own independent cycle, the seventh ray has linked up with the Aquarian cycle. They are independent of each other, but they are working together at this time. I mean, you could have an age of Aquarius accompanied by the sixth ray, or the fifth, or the fourth. But this time, it is the seventh ray. The disciples, therefore, of the Master Maurya, the Master Kutumi, and of the Master Rakuti, are reaching out toward a period of intensest activity. Now, we have to go back to when this was written, and obviously it seems to have been written in the early 30s. The destiny of the world lies in the hands of their three groups of initiated disciples. Now, he also says something similar about the destiny of the world lying in the hands of the United States, Great Britain, or the United Kingdom, but I think Great Britain would be more accurate, and Russia. When it comes to those nations, rays 2 and 7 are there, but not so much ray 1, except in a secondary way, because it is the personality ray of Great Britain. So, three groups of disciples, three nations, three rays in one case, and two rays in another case, 2 and 7. With them, these great masters, the accepted disciples of the three groups are asked to cooperate. And this offers opportunity to many everywhere. As they seek to vision the plan to cooperate with the three masters and their initiate groups, their opportunity will emerge. This triangle of energy is held responsible by the great leaders. There's a number of them, not only Sanat Kumara, by the great leaders in Shambhala for the regularizing of world affairs. More than this, it is not necessary for humanity to know. So probably many of us, maybe to a certain extent, all of us are involved in one of these three groups, at least as approaching disciples, pledged disciples, accepting disciples. To be the accepted disciple is another matter. And that has to be approached, that question, with humility and caution. We have to know what the requirements are, and then conform to them and be accurate in our self-assessment about whether we are conforming to these requirements. But we get the idea now. Three masters and three groups. And in the 1930s, anyway, certain rays producing simultaneous effect upon mankind. Now, it does seem that in some ways, the first ray has subsided. Maybe ever since 1945 and the reduction of the Martian influence that he talks about. It's always there, of course. But the idea of bringing order, the idea of bringing harmony and cooperation, Ray 7, Ray 2, these seem to be, at this present time, the most important kinds of initiatives. So many of us here studying Master DK, studying with Master DK, are involved with the second ray. And our function is as light bearers, and it's a largely educative function, because humanity in their millions and even billions, humanity is in a woeful state of ignorance, and using all that sixth ray zeal of which it is capable to perpetuate forms of relationship which really are outgrown. So it becomes necessary to convince, to illustrate, to demonstrate to human beings that they are hanging on to thoughts, misinterpretations, which are holding them back and holding humanity back. Some people are very very vehement about their grasp of these old forms of thought. They'll throw everything into it. They will believe without the force of reason. And we've seen this in the riots, in the attempted insurrection to subvert democracy in the United States. It's just like the will to believe, regardless of reason, regardless of logic, regardless of common sense. And DK did say, well, the average human being is still a long way from occultism or being able to apprehend occultism. Still, we must make an attempt. There are those who are allowing reason and logic and wider thought into their consciousness. And it is these people who have to be reached. The process goes from belief to reason to broad thinking to intuition. And people are on that continuum somewhere. We just have to take seriously how we will reach the people who are reachable. Some absolutely are not. Their will to believe whatever is so strong that facts don't matter. And some people are speaking of alternative facts. That's a huge contradiction. A fact is a fact. An interpretation of a fact, well, that's another matter. And people are entitled to their own interpretations, but not to their own facts. We have become unhinged from the truth. And when you think about the old saying that the devil, namely the unrestrained powers of the personality, is the father of lies, you really begin to see what's going on today. And how important is the truth, at least as seen from the perspective of high souls. There are always going to be new interpretations of the truth, and the truth will ever widen and deepen and be supplemented by what we have not seen before. But we are in the business of truth. And humanity is carried away by some kind of self congratulatory fantasy. Based upon glamour. This is where our attack must come. Forget not, DK says, an ashram is a vortex of force and a center of energy. So it's not like, you know, you go someplace in India, let's say, and you enter the ashram for a few weeks to meditate and to learn. This is the ashram in terms of energy, a center through which both force and energy flow in order that the vision may be materialized. There are some marvelous definitions of what an ashram actually is. And we have to think of it in subtle terms. Now, for some people, if you're not in India at a certain place, you're not in the ashram. That's not true. When it comes to the consideration of a real ashram, you can be wherever, as long as you are in this vortex of force or center of energy. There's a kind of non-locality to the ashram. This force and energy is, in the last analysis, directed by a master, by a group of three senior initiates. It's beginning to sound quite a bit like the group that the Christ gathered around him, and by another group of lesser initiates, thus representing in each ashram a miniature of the planetary government. The principle of organization is never abandoned. And DK has told us that the story of the Christ and his group is a demonstration of what it means to externalize an ashram. Three senior initiates. So look, there are aspirants, senior aspirants, disciples, senior disciples, initiates, senior initiates. And of course, a true senior initiate is beyond the third degree. We are talking about, We're you know, talking about at least the fourth degree, I would say. And of course, the Christ is the director of other masters. He did not emphasize that so much when he went far down into humanity to gather together probationary initiates, or those almost at that stage. But when he returns to visibility, his senior initiates will be with him. And in fact, if we want to call a master, a senior initiate, masters will be with him. So anyway, there's this reflection, the miniature of a planetary government. And DK also talks about the miniature hierarchy. If you go to chapter 11 in the Rays and the Initiations, how a group is supposed to function, like, as it were, a miniature hierarchy. These step down, the inflowing force, so that accepted disciples can handle it safely and act as distributing agents. You've had the experience, have you not, of stepping energy down? I mean, if you sometimes think of the great physicists who talk to the layman about the physics they are pursuing, and they put it in understandable terms. Was it Richard Feynman who basically said, look, I can tell you all about physics in just a short time, but if you want the details, then you go to graduate school for 7 years. So the idea that if you really understand something, you should be able to explain it in simple terms. And then of course, there are all the details, and that's another matter. And it requires a lot of acuity of mind. Now, going on, the energy with which the masters work come from Shambhala. This must be especially the case with the Chohans, who are members of Shambhala, and they pass that on to the masters in their particular Ray Ashram. The energy with which the masters work comes from Shambhala. The forces with which they work are provided from within hierarchy itself. And just insofar as the accepted disciples react to the combined forces, will it be possible for them to be used in service? So let's distinguish here between energies and forces. So often that's exactly what DK does. And here we'll put forces in the lesser color. Of course, these forces are not low-level external forces. They are high forces, but the energies that prompt them, that make them possible, come from Shambhala. So we're talking, you know, we're really here preparing to discuss accepted discipleship, just the way we had discussed Little Shayla Shipp and Shayla in the Light. So ask yourself, to what extent do I react properly to the forces made available through hierarchy? It's quite a responsibility to be an accepted disciple. The master has taken you on and established a special link, and now your contribution or obstruction within the ashram is much more effective. In other words, it's noticeable. So, accepted discipleship lies ahead for many, but for some of those in the Tibetans group, he said, well, look, you've been an accepted disciple for the last five lives. And for others, he said, this is your first life as an accepted disciple. We see that this whole process is not going to be unduly hastened. There is no rush, no hurry, and yet there is no time to lose. So going on, in other words, the initiated disciples in a master's group focus the inflowing energies. The accepted disciples, through the medium of their souls, focus the force which the master directs outward into the world of men in conformity with the plan of hierarchy, working in accordance with the revelation from Shambhala. So it's one of those synthetic statements. The inflowing energies in this context are again shambolic. And then the master directs certain forces which the accepted disciples can help bring into manifestation in the world. So there is a chain of continuity, a chain of hierarchy in the general sense, from Shambhala to hierarchy to the accepted disciples aspiring towards a real participation in the inner ashram, and on out through the probationary disciples and aspirants until manifestation occurs. It's important for us to understand where we stand in this continuity. Something has to be brought through. Something has to be made to appear on the outer stage of life. And to the extent that we are attuned with the forces projected by the master, we will know what that something is and how we can make it happen. So he's tying it all up together here. And giving us that sense that things are not occurring in a vacuum, completely independent of each other. Somehow, in what we do as accepted disciples, or even as probationary disciples, has its root in the will of God, has its root in Shambhala. Everything really is a modification of the monad. We may use other names. We may say triad, soul, personality, vehicles, etc. But the origin is the monad. Now, there are such demanding statements, and we just have to see, do we accept them? And if we do accept them, do we measure up? Initiated disciples have no interest in anything but the vision, the plan, and its direction, and the materializing, its direction and materializing upon the earth. Sometimes initiates and disciples are accused of being narrow and only interested in one thing. And DK is showing us that indeed this may be the case. Many non-essentials are rejected by initiated disciples. They know what is of the essence, and they're not going to be distracted by other potential interests. Accepted disciples, who are not so well focused, but still very focused, are learning this, and in the meantime, have to react to the vision in what I might call a secondhand manner. Well, a lot of us may feel that we have a vision, an accurate vision, a future-oriented vision. But how much of that has been presented to us by Master DK? In other words, how much of the mountain of vision have we climbed for ourselves? And how much are we taking, as it were, secondhand from him? So these accepted disciples, they are occupied with the plan and with the distribution of the forces that will materialize it. They have to wield certain forces, direct them, apportion them, and make sure they do their job. So if you're thinking of being an accepted disciple, this is telling you what you have to do. That's not what I want. Okay. Sometimes you hit the wrong key, and everything disappears. So, you know, we are striving towards greater usefulness as an accepted disciple. And they have to materialize as much of the divine plan as has come through to them, even if in a so-called second-hand manner. And so another synthetic conclusion. Thus, the entire activity of the ashram is coordinated. Newly accepted disciples who are only learning to cooperate are valuable as agents for experiment according to their reaction to the imparted truths and plan according to their ability to sense the need and to bring the need and the medium of release into relation, that means to fulfill the need, and according to the capacity to work with the world disciples who are definitely responsible to the master of the ashram for some aspect of the plan, will be the success of the effort in the outer world. So this is about the responsibility of the accepted disciples. And then, you know, just always ask yourself. There's a lot of self-questioning in this pursuit of inquiring the way. A lot of what you have to inquire is of yourself. And can I do this? Do I feel like, you know, the new kid on the block? Am I an accepted disciple for the first time? Am I not yet an accepted disciple, but close to that situation of acceptance by the master? Or am I a tried and experienced accepted disciple? Some of whom, of course, are in a way initiates, or we can even use the term accepted initiate, pledged initiate. We don't want to get too caught up in the graded terminology, because to do so leads to a condition of overly much attention to the a little personal self. And so many people suffer from that. World disciples these days, well, everybody travels. That's not the defining criterion. It has to do with influence, whether one travels the world or does not. It has to do with inner responsibility. And the general influence over many or through many. Thus, again, the concept of the hierarchy of relationship is brought to your attention. In these days of world strife, it is this bringing about of right relations which presents the key to the immediate aspect of the vision, which must be precipitated upon our planet. Okay. Therefore, an ashram, another one of those great definitions, is a center wherein relationship is tried out. The bringing about of right relations presents the key to the immediate aspect of the vision. The vision, of course, can be very extensive. It doesn't have to be just that which comprises 100 or 200 years. It can comprise thousands and many more years. But right relations will help us bring through the next aspect of the vision, which must be precipitated. And let's see here. The concept, friends, of the hierarchy of relationship, with no jealousy, belittlement, envy, superiority, interfering with that relationship. When we're in a group, it's not who's higher than whom, and so forth. Those are not our issues. But helping the group work the best it possibly can. Those are our requirements. Those steps which will help the group work the best it can to bring some aspect of the plan into manifestation. Now, going on. One simple question arises here. How can right relations, this is one of those typos in the CD-ROM, be established upon earth if the accepted disciples in a master's group are themselves unable to react to the idea and to preserve among themselves right relations correctly, unanimously, everybody in the group, and unerringly, without making a whole bunch of mistakes? How can we get this desirable state into the world if we ourselves, if we are accepted disciples, can't manage it among ourselves? It is a simple question. I remember something I'd rather forget. It was the night of the full moon. There was going to be a meeting, and somehow an argument arose between myself and one of the group members. And the head of the organization kind of understood what had happened and warned us that we would ruin the entire energy of the evening if we persisted in that type of interplay between ourselves. It was a lesson. I haven't forgotten it. Sometimes the lessons that are most important are hard lessons. And I'm sure that all of us have things we've done, poorly timed, etc., which have lowered the quality of what otherwise might have been. So we, among ourselves, have to produce, preserve right relations based on love and light and the sense of the good. We have to do this without many errors, and we all have to do it within a group, without swerving off the path in order to do it. So just a very straight and simple question. What hope is there for the outer world if the inner circle of workers, pledged disciples, even, you know, before the stage of accepted discipleship, are unable to establish and hold among themselves these right relations? Well, it's just a question that makes sense. If we who are thinking about it so very often and with appreciation for its value, appreciation for the value of right relations, how can we expect others who are much farther from the ongoing consideration of the value of this state be expected to demonstrate such things? It comes down to setting an example. You know, there are the four things that a disciple must do on the path to adeptship: inquire the way, obey the inner impulses of the soul, pay no attention to the worldly wisdom, which is not really the spiritual wisdom, and then finally, to set an example. Maybe that's the hardest thing of all to do, to set that example. Now, at this time, the problem, I assume, the problem of right relations is threefold, and here are the groups or stages between which right relations must be fostered. These right relations must be fostered between accepted disciples, initiate disciples, and the master. Okay, it's a continuity. Between the members of an ashram and other ashrams, because now they are working in greater intimacy and are not so focused only on what they as an ashram are doing, and between all these ashrams and the outer world. So, right human relations are to be fostered between the following. And pause and think. Is such the case in the relations here in which I may be involved? Now, of course, we would have to add, since there are many who are not yet accepted disciples, we'd have to add the accepting pledged probationary disciples. They too have to help to facilitate right human relations, right group relations. The master of an ashram and the senior initiates in his group, fourth degree, are responsible for the relation between Shambhala and hierarchy. Well, this is beyond our scope, but it's good to know. Accepted disciples and the lesser initiates are responsible for the relation between hierarchy and humanity. And then synthetically stated, thus the great chain of hierarchy of being, of the hierarchy of being, is preserved inviolate. So the first has to do with shambolic relations. And the next has to do with hierarchical relations. I think the science of relationship is a huge and foundational science. And we have to look at all of our relations and judge of their quality. If there are cracks in the relationship, points of cleavage, they will appear to the sincere investigator or analyst. If the relationships are accurately and ongoingly, consistently what they should be, that too will appear. And it is necessary for us to mend the cleavages. We have to begin with our own relational and group life, and only then can we hope to work according to community and national relations, and eventually relations within humanity. Well, okay, friends, when I see one of these big parts that I've outlined in red, I know it is time to stop a program. So we'll be getting into accepted discipleship quite strongly now. We've gone to page 732, not really a lot of pages that we've covered, but a new section is now before us. And let's see if I can find that. Whoa, I'm way up there. That's not where I belong. So we're coming then to the end of program 15, which has taken us really only a couple of pages to page 732, but to a new section. And we're beginning with program 16 of the six stages of discipleship from 732, and today is the 12th. I do believe we will continue on the 12th. And get into this third of the major phases of discipleship, which is such an objective for so many of us, since so many of us have been or even are chelas in the light. And we have to ask ourselves now, if students perhaps very much like ourselves, with foibles and errors and personality issues that need correction, could have been selected by Master DK in his group of 24, starting from 1939, 1940, selected as accepted disciples. Why is it not possible for us to do the same, or something very similar? All of these are like internal ashramically related matters. What really does matter is that we prepare ourselves and that we function in a manner which is useful to others, in service. Nobody is going to tell us what type of service we must perform, but it's pretty clear that Master DK has laid out the kind of service work which is flowing from his ashram. And if we really feel drawn to that, then we will be able to select the kind of service in which we will engage. And since the second ray is so important in Master DK's work, we have to assume that the process of education, in a broad and general sense, will be important to those of us who accept him as our teacher and guide, and who move along with his suggestions. Okay, friends, I haven't any idea how long this program is. It's not a regular 1 hour or 2 hour program, but I'll do my best to get back to this work a little later today, if I can. I find it to be so important because from the time about 50 years ago, when I opened up the back of a Bailey book and saw that training for discipleship was being offered by the Arcane School, I have considered it a very important thing in the life of the spiritually inclined student. And maybe you too, I suspect, will want to improve the quality of your discipleship, so we have the means of doing so. And as we do so, we are filled with the impulse to share the opportunity to share the opportunity with others. So, lots of love and many blessings from Tuya and myself and the whole communications crew, the team that does so much to bring the ageless wisdom to you in a more assimilable form, so you can use it in your self-improvement, group improvement, and in your service. And we'll see you before long. Bye-bye.